Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and today my guest is Deborah Treisman. She's been engaged with a special project. Once upon a time, there was an art curator who began his history in Los Angeles. His name was Walter Hopps. He opened galleries, did the first shows here of Andy Warhol's Soup Cans, of Marcel Duchamp. He brought Max Ernst back into prominence. He showed a good deal of Joseph Cornell. In addition to all this and much, much more, he ends up at the Smithsonian. He's the modern art man of his generation. And in addition, he was a spectacular raconteur. He's thought to have been one of the best talkers about art. And unlike most curators, everyone, all the artists love him because he's trying to understand art more than he's trying to sell it. And he's trying to understand it at the same time that they're trying to understand it and find words for what they're doing. Now, Deborah, at a certain time, comes up with the project of wanting to capture this man's voice because he didn't like to write. He liked to talk. Deborah, at that time, was the editor, the literature editor of the wonderful magazine Grand Street. Now she is the primary fiction editor at The New Yorker. So she is an editor, and it took a long time for this book to come together. Well, tell me why.
Oh, well, so I knew Walter when I worked at Grand Street in the mid-90s.
He was the art editor.
He was the art editor of Grand Street. And at the same time, he was working at the Menil Collection in Houston, which he was a co-founder of, the founding director of. And he, as you said, he didn't like to write. He liked to talk. And so whenever he had to write something about an artist for the magazine, we would work it in this way. He would speak to me or to the editor of the magazine, Gene Stein, or to our assistant art editor, Ann Doran, and I would take the taped conversation and turn that into a written piece. And somehow this manner of working suited him, it suited me. I really liked the sense of capturing what he had to say, because he was such a riveting speaker and because he made you look at things, he made you look at art very differently from any way I had looked at it before. So at some point, it was actually a few years later, I had moved on to The New Yorker already, but I had still worked with Walter on some art catalog essays for big shows he'd been doing of James Rosenquist, Joseph Cornell, Duchamp, and so on. And we just thought, let's get it all down. You know, why do these small things when we could do your whole career as someone in the art world who's been seminal and who had changed things, particularly on the West Coast. So we came up with a plan whereby Ann Doran was going to spend time in Houston and interview Walter and tape him, and she had known him for many years, for decades. And the tapes then would come to me, and I would listen to them, transcribe them in a fashion, sort of already editing, and in the end, build a draft of a book. Which would be a memoir, but also chapters about artists, and capture this voice, which I was enamored by, which so many people were enamored by in the art world. And we got started with the project and taped about 100 hours of interviews. And then in 2005, I had really only the first chapter edited and in place, and Walter unfortunately died at age 72. And then that took a little steam out of the project. I knew I wouldn't be able to go back to him to fill in gaps and to sort of consult with. And I had a full-time job. It took me a very long time then to wrangle these many, many, many thousands of words into a structure and into a book. But I didn't ever want to give up on it. So eventually we got there, and Bloomsbury is the publisher, stuck by it, and has put it out into the world.
Well, it's sort of remarkable because Walter Hobbs, I guess by officially Walter Hobbs III.
Walter Wayne Hobbs III, yes.
Yes. opens his first gallery in Los Angeles at age 24.
Yeah, so that was his second gallery, actually. The first one was Sindel Studio, which he founded at 21. The second one, Ferris, which he and Ed Kienholz started in 1957, basically was the home of a whole new school of California artists.
Well, not just a whole new school of California artists. It's California's entry into
the art world.
The art world, yeah, that was taking its shape after abstract expressionism, and it was gaining its own standing,
yeah,
alongside New York art and what art world we now are proud of in Los Angeles is very much the descendant,
yeah,
of what Walter Hobbs started.
Yeah.
And he gave the notoriously reticent, nonverbal Los Angeles artists a language to talk about themselves in. Where do you suppose his vocal gifts came from?
Well, he was a child of doctors. His family, he had, you know, doctor grandparents, parents, and he grew up in a world where it was assumed he would be a scientist or work in medicine. And at some point,
wow.
He was born in Eagle Rock. He grew up in Eagle Rock. He was enrolled in a weekend program for students, high school students who were gifted in math and science, in order to introduce them to the arts and to culture. You know, they were seen as too science-oriented. These were the science nerds, and they needed to be taught something about art. And he was 15 at the time, and a fellow member of the group was Susan Sontag. And so on Saturdays, they would go around to museums. They would be taken to speak to people who knew something about art. This was how he discovered or rediscovered Kurt Schwitters and other artists. One day, they were taken to the home of the collectors, Walter and Louise Arensberg. And Walter walked in the doorway of this house and saw Duchamp works for the first time, saw Mondrian for the first time, saw de Chirico, Magritte. And a world opened for him.
And my understanding is, from reading the book, that he was so excited that he never left.
Basically.
And Mrs. Arensberg said, "You seem so engrossed. Would you like to come back?"
Yeah.
And then eventually he's looking at a sculpture, and she says to him, "Would you like to bring it to the table and have lunch?"
She came upon him in the library, petting a Brancusi. And he was rather shamefaced. And she said, "Walter, you seem very interested in this work. Why don't you carry it down to luncheon so you can go on looking at it?" And so this wonderful older couple saw something in him. And art really became the focus of his life from that moment.
And, you know, he comes to work for the Pasadena Museum of Art.
When he was hired there in 62, the director was Thomas Levitt, whom he thought of as a wonderful supporter of his work. He used to say that whenever he wanted to do a show, Levitt had two questions, and they were, can we afford it, and can we pull it off? And if the answer was yes, Walter could do what he wanted. So there at Pasadena, he gave Duchamp his first museum show in America.
Wow.
And
so it's at the Armory show that Duchamp's Nude Descending a Staircase appeared, but
that,
this
that
is
was
the
a
first
group show. This was the first retrospective
this is the
of
first complete
Duchamp's
show of
career.
Duchamp.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And he had Duchamp out there in Pasadena staying at the Green Hotel and going to the museum every day and loving the whole experience.
I'm talking to Deborah Treisman. She's the editor of the book called The Dream Colony. It's the memoir of the curator Walter Hopps. It's his life in art. It's drawn from at least 100 hours of tapes by him. He was one of the people who changed the world of art.
Soon after Duchamp died, he went to Duchamp's studio, and he had, Duchamp at that point had said he wasn't making art anymore, he wasn't doing anything. And Walter had his suspicions, and he walked into the studio and stumbled across the work Étant donné, which is, you know, this incredible work of a woman seen through a hole in a, basically a peephole, and this elaborate scene behind it. Walter walks in and sees a hole in a door and looks through it, and in that way becomes one of the very first people ever to see this work. And he spent a life making discoveries like this. And I think, you know, the question, one of the questions to ask is why the artists let him in. Why was he there? Why was he at Joseph Cornell's house after he died, going through the books looking for hidden works and finding them? And I think it really just had something to do with how he looked at work and his enormous excitement about it. Enormous excitement when he found someone doing something different or new or that stopped him, that he had to really stare at and understand.
And, you know, there's something about someone who, without showing off too much, can tell a story so that all of its pieces are thrown into the air and then fall together in a very nice way by the end of the story. And Hopps is plainly one of them. When he talks about photography, he does so well in distinguishing where this or that photographer places himself in relation to what he's shooting, and that this is, in fact, the distinction between the burgeoning art of photography, which Hopps was central to. He was one of the people who was practically demanding that museums start to include photography and folk art too.
Yeah. You know, in a way, he's almost like a scientist of art. And what's very he's not interested in academic theory. He never was. What was important to him was the sort of alchemy by which art was actually physically made. And some of his most exciting moments were moments when he got to sit in the studio and simply watch someone make a painting or make a sculpture.
But it's fun to hear him. I think that anyone who grows up around L.A. or around L.A. art can have a good time reading The Dream Colony, because so much of our localness is contained here. Mm-hmm. He was prepared to find art in so many different places.
Yeah.
It wasn't a rule that you had to be educated in a certain way or prepared to use your education in a certain way. He was interested in recognizing those places, as you say, alchemical places, where art shows up out of an inexplicable combination.
Mm-hmm. And he was not at all orthodox in his own education. I mean, he studied science and never actually finished a degree. But at the same time, his education was simply in seeing and viewing and doing. And he really saw art everywhere. I mean, there were two shows I think of. One, when he was at Sindel Studio in his 20s and he'd been away and he had an opening scheduled and no show. And it was the night before he went to his, you know, the people he worked with, and who were basically his friends. Some of them were artists, some of them were poets. And he said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to split up. We're all going to walk in different directions. We're going to bring back some art. We're going to bring back what we find, and we're going to hang it on the walls. And the show is called As Found. And that's what they did. I don't know what they found. It wasn't intended as art. Could be viewed as art once it was hung on the wall. And years later in D.C., I think in 1978, he staged a show at the Museum of Temporary Art called 36 Hours. And he said, I'm going to hang anything that is brought to me that fits through the door in the next 36 hours. He had artists lined up down the street, around the corner. He hung for 36 hours, probably helped along by some form of medication, and filled this museum with what became an incredible show that everybody who was there remembers. So for him, part of the pleasure was the finding.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Deborah Treisman about her book, The Dream Colony, A Life in Art. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life in Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life in Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life in Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Deborah Treisman about her latest book, The Dream Colony, stories from the visionary and quirky life of one of the most relevant art curators of the century, and the past century as well. He says in one of these transcribed recordings that poets are the couriers of the new art, because poets traveling among the beats from place to place, they see the art of wherever they're visiting. Robert Creeley reports about an artist to Wallace Berman. Wallace Berman tells Walter Hobbs, take a look if you find him, because he might be interesting. Hobbs finds it interesting. But one of the things that was crucial at that time in poetry was the idea of found poetry, that poetry was not just the product of the poet's mind, it's the world yielding things that were already poems. And so, you know, the found work of art and making a show of such things becomes part of the originality of the time, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. And obviously, I think in the back of his head, there was Duchamp, you know, who was the first, one of the first finders of art. But I love that moment in the book, you know, where he talks about the poets as the message bearers, the ones who bring the news from elsewhere of art. And this, in a way, you know, this is in the late 50s, and there was no internet. They were the internet. So this was how news of creation traveled. People traveled, and they brought it with them.
Now, Deborah, tell me, you're the fiction editor at The New Yorker. To what extent was working on this book like working on a manuscript that you would publish in The New Yorker?
Well, I also edit nonfiction at The New Yorker, but for me, the thrill of Walter was his storytelling. And there are certain rules for storytelling, whether it's fictional or nonfictional, and he had an incredible grasp on that. He had a grasp on the suspense of storytelling, and so this was something that he did with friends or on the phone or at dinner. But when it's written down, it can become another thing. And so the challenge was taking that spoken voice and making stories that you can read on paper and appreciate. And so that it used a lot of the same energy that editing fiction uses.
Well, we have a very brief clip of Walter Hobbs talking about Andy Warhol. This was the first show of the Soup Cans. And you can get a sense of someone who both knows what he's talking about and how to improvise about it at the same time. But let's at least hear his voice. It wouldn't be fair to talk about him so much without hearing him. Here we go.
Warhol was fascinated with the idea of having a show in Hollywood, and the very first show of his pop art was at the New Ferris Gallery. And the 32 original Campbell soup cans, which were part stencil and part hand-painted, and there were 32 of them, all different brands. Kidney bean, tomato, pea, you name it. They're done in a very stylized, precise way, except the gold emblem is just a round gold circle. He didn't fill in all the detail, the official Campbell logo, which you'll see on a can. He simplified it. Subsequently, he did smaller versions, canvases where the soup can is smaller, and he did bigger ones. He did one with the label partially ripped off. He did all sorts of variations on it. He came west for that show, and that show was happening right when I went to the Pasadena Art Museum, and that's the last show I had to do with in the New Ferris. But I remember talking with Andy about how would he describe the soup cans. They're just in the black and red and gold on a white canvas ground, centered up on both axes, just as simple as they could be. All right, I asked him what he thought of them, and he gave me a funny smile and he said, "I think they're portraits, don't you?" I never asked him further what he meant by that.
Okay, Deborah. When Warhol says that he thinks the soup cans are like portraits, don't you? It seems like Hobbes's great gift is not to answer that question. He knows when to keep his mouth shut.
Yeah. And he thought Warhol was wonderful. I mean, he had heard about him through someone else, and he and Irving Blum, who was also involved with Ferris at that time, had gone to New York, gone to his studio. Warhol hadn't shown this work anywhere. He'd shown very little work. And he liked the idea, as Walter said, of having a show in Hollywood. That appealed to him. So he shipped off these 32 soup cans. And I think it was Irving Blum who had this brainstorm to lay it out, to put them all on the shelf in a row the way you would with actual soup cans. And Walter at the time was starting at the Pasadena Art Museum, and where he put on what was really the first pop art show. Looking at Warhol, looking at other work other people were doing, he recognized that there were many people working with depictions of what we think of as common objects. And he called this the new painting of common objects. The pop art, the term, didn't exist yet. But he pulled together all of these works, which now we call pop art. And it was part of his just understanding what was on the ether, was seeing people in different places doing something that related to each other, whether they'd seen each other's work or not, that something was happening, and finding a way to present that so that people walking through a museum would understand what was happening.
One of the things that a reader of The Dream Colony will discover by the time you get to the chronology of Walter's work, he begins as an outsider and a young Turk, but by the end, he's getting all sorts of awards as a grandpa, as the father of a certain kind of curatorial discipline. And what's so interesting to me is that when you get there, you're aware of how much family meant to Walter Hobbes. There are so many stories here of his great-grandfather, of his grandfather, of his father, of his mother. He's very, very sympathetic to artists who are relatively unparented to who was it whose parents had him sleeping on the porch until his mother brought him inside?
Rauschenberg. Yeah.
You know, and Walter Hopps says in the narration, they kept him out there like the family dog.
Yeah.
And you can just hear how sympathetic he is. He is to these artists, a parent and then a grandparent, and he really, you know, becomes the familial figure for a lot of artists. It's a fascinating story. Tell me about the title. Why the Dream Colony?
Oh, you know, he worked in the 70s. He was, Walter lost a lot of jobs as well as being hired for a lot of jobs. So at a certain point, in the late 60s, I suppose, he was fired from Pasadena, the Pasadena Art Museum, and he was a little bit at odds. He wasn't sure what to do next, and a wonderful friend and mentor, art collector Ed Jantz, whose own family was part of the creation of L.A. as we know it, knew a man called Marcus Raskin, who was running the Institute for Policy Studies in D.C., which was a left-wing think tank. And he just thought Walter would have something to contribute to the conversation there. He said, go spend a year and, you know, get your bearings. And so Walter went to this place and absolutely loved the kind of exchanges he was having there, loved being asked simply to think. So he read Marcus Raskin's book, Being and Doing, in which Raskin sort of assigns the basic groups of society. There's a plantation colony or the worker colony. We're all in our own colony. And here are the artists in their dream colony.
Wow.
And they're not having a whole lot of effect, but they're popping up in our dreams. They're floating up there above us. And Walter loved this idea of artists as inhabiting the world of dreams. So he was very clear that was always going to be his title.
I love it. I've been talking with Deborah Treisman, the editor, redeveloper, structurer of Walter Hopps's verbal memoir. It's his life and art. The book is called The Dream Colony. It's published by Bloomsbury. Thank you very much, Deborah. It's been
a
pleasure
talking to
you. Thank
you, Michael. My pleasure.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Dream Colony at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Wallace Shawn is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.